previously on Unsolved.
So I ran across the street to the school. And when I went to the school and I asked Miss Rulin, was Alexis, where's Alexis? And she said, she turned around and she looked at me. I'll never forget her face. She said, Alexis haven't made it to school. Alexis didn't come to school today.
Every tip we had came back to that family. And it became apparent that something tragically went wrong in that house.
From USA Today and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, this is Unsolved Season 4, A Missing Girl, A Search for Truth. I'm Gina Barton. Chapter 2, A Guilty Man That Walked Free. On the morning of October 28, 1994, a man with a gun robbed a bank in Glendale, Wisconsin, a suburb of Milwaukee. As he fled, he fired at a police officer. People were glued to their television sets all day, waiting for details on the manhunt and the officer's condition.
Breaking news, a Glendale police officer shot after a bank robbery this morning in Glendale. Doane Hospital telling us moments ago that they are not releasing any more information on him until his family has been notified. The shooting happened at Port Washington Road in Capitol. We're going to go right now to Colleen Henry, who was at the scene and has been on this story since it broke. Colleen, what is the latest?
Mike, the latest is that police are still looking for the suspect and they have taken to the skies. A police officer just moments ago took to the skies with our Chopper 12 helicopter, and they are searching for a wounded suspect they believe is in a wooded area behind the Koss headphone factory. Now, as you said, the bank robbery happened at the Bank One at 2nd and Capitol, but folks, the police and the suspect, police chased the suspect about 6-7 blocks to this area near the Koss factory. They believe he may have escaped into that wooded area where police are now searching.
Alexis Patterson wouldn't be born until the following year. Her mother, Ayanna Patterson, had not yet met the man who would become Alexis's stepfather, Laurent Bourgeois. But the bank robbery and its aftermath would loom large when Alexis disappeared 8 years later. The officer who was shot that day in 1994 was named Ronald Headbenny. The gunman got away, even though dozens of cops from both Milwaukee and Glendale spent the entire day looking for him. That evening, Police Chief Thomas Czarniecka announced that Headbenny had died.
Ron is 42 years old, and he's been a member of the Glendale Police Department since 1981. Ron has had several letters of commendation in his file regarding his actions as a police officer and his tenure with the Glendale Police Department.
Czarniecka is retired now. All these years later, he still didn't want to talk about Ron Headbenny's death. But the current police chief, Mark Ferguson, did agree to talk with me. Ferguson was a patrol officer in Glendale when Headbenny was murdered. He said Headbenny's death hit the department hard.
Having one of your own officers shot and killed, and you're there with them, when this is all going down, it's a pretty traumatic event on a lot of the guys. It was very hard. Everyone was very upset and kind of in shock.
Ron didn't have a wife or children, but he did have an identical twin brother. Don Headbenny spoke with television reporters in the aftermath of his brother Ron's death.
He used to say to me, and I used to respond, he would always say, "Don't ever leave me, Don." And I told him, "Don't ever leave me, Ron."
But he will never be forgotten, nor will he ever be out of my heart. He'll always live within my heart all my life.
I spoke with Don over the summer. He told me that on the morning of the bank robbery, he felt kind of sick while he was eating breakfast. He was supposed to go fishing with a friend and thought about canceling, but he went ahead and started packing up his gear anyway. That's when the news bulletin came on. Don told me as soon as he heard that a Glendale police officer had been shot, he knew it was his brother. They shared one of those deep connections you often hear about twins having.
When you lose a twin, I know people don't understand, but when you lose a twin, you lose part of yourself.
The Milwaukee police were in charge of the investigation since they had a lot more experience with homicide cases than the Glendale police. Even so, the case went unsolved for more than 4 months. One of the detectives who worked on it was Steve Spingola, who we heard from in the first episode. He told me the Head Benny case finally broke open when a woman came forward and told them that the bank robber they were looking for, the one who killed a cop, was a man named Booker Shipp.
And she said, I can tell you, which one of the things we had never released to the public, I can tell you exactly how much money was obtained in that bank robbery the day that cop got killed. And we said, how much? And she threw out like $13,111 to the penny. And it was never been released to anybody. So we knew right away what she was talking about.
The woman also told the police how Shipp got away. He didn't run through the woods. He had a getaway driver, a man who was waiting a few blocks away. She also told the cops the driver's name, Laurent Bourgeois. So the police arrested Booker Shipp and Laurent Bourgeois, who you'll recall would later marry Alexis Patterson's mother. But even after the cops made those arrests, they still didn't have much of a case. They had the woman saying Shipp did it. The police also found a bandana and a hat a few blocks from the bank. Witnesses had described the shooter wearing similar items, but there was no solid proof that they belonged to him. The police and the prosecutors felt there was really only one way to get a conviction. Mark Williams was a Milwaukee County homicide prosecutor back then, and he remembers the break in the case.
You know, one of the reasons that sparked my memory is because, and I'll never forget this, is that we had no or very little leads in the Head Benny homicide. And obviously a policeman being murdered is a big deal. And I got a call like at 4 a.m. one night, and the cops thought they had a lead, and they asked me to come down to the police station. And I came down, and Laurent was there with his lawyer. His lawyer said, look, he'll talk to you. He'll tell you what he knows about the murder, but he wants complete immunity. So after a long pause and a long thinking, because we don't ordinarily give out immunity, we decided to give him immunity for what he told us, and that he implicated Booker Shipp in the murder and implicated himself as the driver.
The Glendale police were not happy with the idea that Laurent was going to get away with what he did, and neither was Don Headbenny.
Well, I didn't like it, but they all talked to me saying that it was the only way we could put Shipp into life in prison, you know, to get somebody to squeal on.
Here's the current Glendale police chief, Mark Ferguson.
There was not a lot of information that the Milwaukee Police Department had to go on. So for them to even get to the conclusion of the case was I think, exceptional. And we all know, yeah, they're going to have to make a deal with Iran. And nobody likes that, but that's the only way we're going to be able to get this case solved. So I don't think anybody liked it.
But the deal was made. Booker Shipp went to trial, and Laurent Bourgeois testified against him. Booker was convicted and sentenced to life in prison. And the charges against Laurent were dropped.
As far as I'm concerned, I was a guilty man that walked free.
More after the break.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's so easy to get caught up in what everyone else needs from you and never take a moment to think about what you need for yourself. So often, our plans for self-care fall apart. The visit to the salon is too expensive. There's too much work for a vacation. There's no time for relaxing because someone in our lives always seems to need something. But you can't take care of others if you don't take care of yourself first. If you're burned out, it's impossible to be there when loved ones need you. Balance is the key, and therapy can give you the tools to find more balance in your life. A trained therapist can do more than just listen. They can help you learn coping skills, manage your emotions, and set healthy boundaries. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so you can save yourself the commute. It's also flexible, which makes it easy to fit into your busy schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to be matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find more balance with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/UN today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, help.com/UN.
About 2 years after the bank robbery, Ayanna Patterson met Laurent Bourgeois. She was 16. He was 28. Ayanna told me she had no idea about Laurent's criminal past when she married him. She said she knew nothing about his involvement with the bank robbery or with Ron Headbenny's killing until the police told her about it after Alexis vanished. Even so, Ayanna stuck by Laurent for months, even as the police tried to convince her he was involved in her daughter's disappearance. Alexis's Head Start teacher, Lisa Quinones, says she never saw any issues with Laurent.
Alexis was fine with him. She didn't hesitate when he came. She'd run up to him and hug him, and he would pick her up, you know, and say, come on, baby, you're ready to go, you know, just like most dads. So I would never think that he was like, Laurent would be like the abusive type to her or any of that. He was very loving when it came to Alexis.
But for the police, Laurent's involvement with the bank robbery and the death of a fellow cop was enough to raise suspicions immediately.
I mean, this guy is a hardened criminal. He's a drug dealer. He hates the police.
I checked Laurent's criminal background, and he did have a record by 2002. He had been convicted of drug dealing and failure to pay child support for one of his biological children. I'm not so sure that qualifies him as a hardened criminal. In any case, the Milwaukee police looked closely at Laurent, and Detective Spingola told me they found two things that moved him to the top of the suspect list. I hadn't heard about either of these incidents before now.
We subpoenaed phone records from inside of their house. At about 6 a.m. on May 3rd, 2002, there was a phone call placed from the Patterson residence to the old St. Michael's Hospital where somebody asked for help. It was transferred, and then at that end, the phone went dead from inside the residence of Laurent and Ayanna. Somebody hung up the phone.
But Spingola says the police never could figure out whether a man, a woman, or even a child made that call. Mark Williams, who you heard talking about the bank robbery at the beginning of this episode, was also the prosecutor on Alexis's case. He vaguely remembered something about a call to the hospital. Kathy Spano, who worked as a cold case investigator for several years before she retired in 2017, remembers reading about it in Alexis's case file. Kathy spoke with my reporting partner, Ashley Lutheran, from her car.
That call to the hospital that morning, that is, you know, that's just a red flag that something had happened.
But she said the call alone wasn't enough to conclude that Laurent had killed Alexis.
I had a feeling that he had knowledge, but I didn't have a feeling that he was involved in her murder or a murder. He actually seemed to be fond of her and spoke fondly of her.
Another thing Spingola told me that I didn't know before is that the police brought in a cadaver dog to search Alexis's house and her stepfather's car. These dogs are specially trained to detect the scent of human decomposition.
They called the FBI. They brought a guy in. He used to be a Texas Ranger. He trained cadaver dogs. They said, this is the best dog we ever had. I called. They flew the dog up to us. It was incredible. The FBI paid for the whole thing.
I've been covering criminal justice for 20 years. And while I've heard about dogs finding dead bodies, I've never heard of them catching enough of a scent to show the police where a body had been. To learn more about these dogs, I called Jean Pappett, who is the executive director of Canine Resources in Ohio, where he trains scent dogs for law enforcement. He also co-authored a book on the topic called Canine Olfaction Science and Law under the name L.E. Pappett. Jean told me dogs can be trained to detect almost anything, including residual chemicals from dead bodies, but they're only as good as the humans who train and supervise them.
I trust dogs. I love dogs. But it's the people that I am very suspicious of. The key to it really goes back to the training and the handling of the dog. And that's where the human becomes involved. And quite frankly, it's not uncommon, not only in law enforcement circles, but in canine cases or canine situations of all type. The handlers begin to believe that they know more than the dog does, and that's where the trouble starts.
Still, Detective Spingola had a lot of faith in this dog. He said the dog alerted in the basement of Alexis's house. After that, the handler brought it outside to rest.
We're sitting on a picnic table in the backyard, gave the dog some water. The dog, as the wind blew from the west, jumped up and went over and hit on the trunk of Laurent's car. Immediately hit on the trunk of Laurent's car.
Gene Pappett had some thoughts on that scenario.
Let me tell you what more than likely happened. We see it happen quite routinely. You know, the handler shows up on the scene, and the FBI agent or another cop or whoever it is, they do what's called a briefing. They'll say, well, we're going to have you run your cadaver dog downstairs in the basement of this home. So instead of having them run the whole house, they take them down to the basement. Mm-hmm. Well, that's an implicit bias for, you know, they're instilling the thought that's where the odor is. And that's wrong. They shouldn't do that. You know, they ought to have them run three houses and not tell them a damn thing.
Detective Spingola told me the police got warrants to search the house and the car.
You know, in defense of Laurent and Ayanna, there was no blood. There was no blood spatter. There was nothing in that house. We went through the car. There was nothing in it. However, that dog, he was a recognized expert. This dog had a resume of a number of fines. It was probably the best dog the FBI had ever used.
Gene Pappett said he hears that all the time, even with dogs that are no more accurate than a coin flip. Even if the dog in Alexis's case had a great success rate, the fact that Alexis had been inside both the house and the car may have caused the dog to get confused.
Some cadaver dog handlers train their dogs on teeth and on blood and on all types of other tissues, okay? So for the dog to alert, if that dog is not absolutely pristinely trained, it's very likely that that young lady's odor is going to be all over that house.
Oh, and the dog wouldn't necessarily be able to differentiate between living
there
or...
You got it.
Okay.
You got it.
Okay.
You got it. Unless you can verify it, it should not count as a positive for the dog. And the way you verify it is you collect evidence, you have it tested. If there's material present, then great, it's a plus for the dog. If there's no evidence present, it should not count as a positive for the dog.
Detective Spingola couldn't remember the name of the dog or the handler, so I couldn't check their training records. He did remember taking the information about the dog to the prosecutor, who told him it wasn't enough for an arrest. Mark Williams told us he didn't remember whether or not a cadaver dog was brought in. We'll have more after the break.
Losing control of your nude images online is terrifying. And if you're a teen, it may feel impossible to reverse it. While you can't go back in time and unsend, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children can help you move forward. Visit takeitdown.ncmec.org to help delete your explicit images.
If you've listened to previous seasons of this show, at this point, you would be expecting me to say the police wouldn't answer specific questions about the evidence in the case, like the phone call to the hospital or the cadaver dog. And then I would tell you, undoubtedly in a very frustrated tone of voice, that the police wouldn't give me the records in this case, which would answer all those questions and more. And in the early cuts of this show, which I wrote back in October of 2022, that's what I said. Here's a clip. My biggest challenge in reporting this season has been the fact that the Milwaukee police won't let me read the files in Alexis Patterson's case. I'm told there are at least two file cabinets full of documents, and those are just from the early days of the case, before the police department started storing all of its case files electronically. Around the country, there are public records laws that allow journalists and members of the public to access certain documents compiled by government workers. Wisconsin's law says police reports are public, and law enforcement agencies have to turn them over to anyone who wants to see them. But there's an exception. If the case is still open, and the police think publicity would harm the investigation, they don't have to give up the files. Under the law, they could share the files in an open case if they wanted to. You may recall that in season one of this show, the police in Hales Corners, Wisconsin, gave me thousands of pages of records in the John Zara case, even though his killer has never been found. But in Alexis's case, the Milwaukee Police Department isn't budging. They gave me the original missing report. 2 pages. That's it. My editor at USA Today, Amy Pyle, weighed in when she heard that. Here's Amy reading the note she wrote to me about it.
Have we gotten attorneys involved? I assume so, but want to if not. I think we could make a case for publicity being crucial, etc.
The truth is, we hadn't gotten the attorneys involved. After 20 years of covering the Milwaukee police, I'd gotten used to them withholding records. I'd even gotten used to them withholding records in Alexis's case. By that point, both Ashley Luthern, the Journal Sentinel reporter I'm working with this season, and I had requested those files, and both of us had been denied. So even though I thought it was a long shot that wouldn't go anywhere, Ashley and I got in touch with our lawyer at USA Today, and he referred us to a Wisconsin lawyer we hadn't worked with before. His name is Tom Kamenick, and he's the president and founder of the Wisconsin Transparency Project, the state's only law firm dedicated to open government. When I talked to Tom, he told me that even in an open case, the police aren't allowed to just withhold everything. They're supposed to evaluate every single police report individually.
But surprisingly, there actually is no blanket exception for an open investigation. If the police are investigating a crime, a potential crime, they should not just be saying, this is an open investigation, we won't turn over any records.
But that's what they've been telling me for 20 years. So why were they telling me that?
I keep seeing this from different law enforcement agencies around the state, and it's just wrong. There's no blanket exemption. They can't just say it's an open investigation. You don't get anything. Now, what they can do is look on a record by record basis to see if releasing something would interfere with the investigation. We don't want to make it harder for the police to do their job. So if releasing information would tip off a suspect that's not aware of the investigation yet, or might put somebody's safety in danger, like a confidential informant, or if just releasing everything is so speculative right now, it would just be wild and guesswork, they can withhold some of that to preserve the integrity of their investigation so it doesn't go off the rails. But they're supposed to do that on a record-by-record basis and release as much as they can.
Tom wrote a letter to the Milwaukee Police Department and reminded them of that. He also made a really effective argument on our behalf.
Just practicality, this particular investigation has been open for so long and hasn't been going anywhere that it seems like there's not really anything to interfere with anymore at this point. That if you open up this information, there are a lot of journalists out there, a lot of amateur sleuths, a lot of people who just care a lot about this, who can look through it, and you know, many hands make light work, and sometimes that you open it up to the public and they can find things out that previously went undiscovered.
And when we got the reply from the police department, I have to tell you, I was shocked. Tom gave us the news in an email.
They've come around and they will be releasing substantial portions of the Alexis Patterson file. They'll still have to go through everything to see what needs to be withheld, so it'll take a little while, but they will be doing a rolling release.
So stay tuned. In the meantime, I want to get back to where we left off in May 2002. About a week and a half after Alexis disappeared, reporter Crocker Stevenson knocked on the door of the house where LaRon and Ayanna lived. Back then, Crocker was writing a column for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's retired now. Crocker told me Ayanna was distraught, desperate to do anything she could to help bring her daughter home. But he said LaRon was standoffish.
We were at their kitchen table, and he was sitting away from the table with his arms crossed. And when I would ask him a question, he would say, no, just, you know, Ayanna's going to answer these questions.
While Crocker was a bit put off, he could somewhat understand why LaRon was acting that way.
I think at that point, there had been some question of whether he had passed a lie detector test or not, and he had become a suspect. I mean, the police had said as much, and so he had become wary of the media by that point.
Crocker told me LaRon did not want to talk about the fact that the police were investigating the possibility that he was involved with Alexis's disappearance.
He did not want to talk about that. In fact, was very, very angry at this whole idea that he was a suspect.
So did you get the idea that he was denying having anything to do with it?
LaRon flatly denied having anything to do with it.
But Crocker said he had a gut feeling about LaRon, and it wasn't a good one.
LaRon could see it in my eyes that I didn't believe him. I didn't believe him.
Steve Spingola felt the same way.
And while LaRon wasn't the biological father and he was a drug dealer, he was more of a father than her biological father and basically was the caregiver of Ayanna and a child that Ayanna had with LaRon. And it just, like I said, it just kept coming back to them. It was that feel, that gut feeling. I can't explain it.
Ayanna told me that Alexis's biological father, Kenya Campbell, wasn't involved in their daughter's life. She said LaRon was the only father Alexis knew. Kenya had a different take. He told me he was a part of Alexis's life, and she was special to him.
Out of all my children, I never had to physically discipline Alexis or talk to her, give her lectures. I never had to, not in my household. She was loved. She was very loved. She was very loved.
Kenya says when a detective questioned him in the aftermath of Alexis's disappearance, the first thing the detective asked about was drugs.
I was expecting him to ask questions like, where do you think she, do you think that she was kidnapped or something like that? But he didn't ask me no questions. He asked me straight to drug questions like, is your old lady outstanding drug debt?
The theory seemed to be that perhaps someone kidnapped Alexis as collateral to get a drug debt repaid. Kenya admits he sold drugs, but says he never tried to rip off his suppliers. According to Kenya, though, LaRon was a different story.
A person he was affiliated with, a drug dealer he was affiliated with, had fronted him some drugs, and he had staged a fake drug raid. And what he did was he, like, you know, tore the house up a little bit, took drawers out, dumped them out, stuff like that.
After that, LaRon asked the guy to come over so he could see the mess and claimed the police had confiscated the cocaine, which, as Kenya tells it, had a street value of $50,000. But Kenya says LaRon forgot one very important detail.
LaRon didn't understand was when the police raid, they have a search warrant. And they supply you with that search warrant when they raid.
Kenya says that because LaRon didn't have a copy of the warrant, the supplier got suspicious, and he didn't buy the idea that the cops had confiscated the drugs. Instead, he started to think that LaRon had stolen them. Kenya also has a theory about why LaRon may have gotten nervous during the polygraph. He thinks LaRon was worried that while the police were searching for Alexis, they would find the stolen cocaine. Kenya and I talked about that during one of my interviews with him.
And so where did he hide the stolen cocaine, and how is it possible that the police never found it?
Okay, because it was a doghouse in the backyard that the police never looked up under the doghouse.
But like when all that time they were looking for Alexis, they never looked in the doghouse?
All that time they were looking for Alexis, all the time the people were gathered at their house, all the time the news media was in front of the house, the dog was up under the doghouse.
Kenya told me the drug supplier's name, and court records confirm that this man was convicted of a federal drug charge the year after Alexis vanished. He spent more than 11 years in prison. He got out in 2014, but Ashley and I couldn't find him anywhere. The Milwaukee house listed as his address in the court file had been condemned. I even went to Dallas, where I'd found an address for his mother. No one answered when I knocked on the door. I left a note, but no one replied. I was still able to corroborate at least part of the story. Detective Spingola recalls LaRon having a vicious dog.
He had a pit bull in the back of that yard that I'm telling you hated, I think, everybody but two people in the world, the guy who fed him and the guy that, I don't know, would take care of him. But we couldn't get near that dog. And the rumor we got later was that LaRon actually kept his drugs, kept them outside in a hole underneath the doghouse, knowing that no cops are going to get anywhere near that dog. So LaRon was kind of a pretty street smart guy.
Mark Williams, the prosecutor, took it a step further during a conversation he had with Ashley.
What do you think happened to Alexis?
The best theory is that someone owed a debt, perhaps a drug debt, and they use Alexis as a pawn to maybe try to collect that drug debt. This is total speculation. And they snatched her, and no one knows really what happened after that.
You might have noticed the audio of my conversations with Kenya isn't the best quality. That's because he was talking to me from prison, and he wasn't there for selling drugs.
Breaking news now from Milwaukee. The biological father of a missing girl in Milwaukee now charged with beating an 8-month-old nearly to death. The father of Alexis Patterson is sitting in jail right now for the disturbing allegations.
Jailers are keeping an eye on him after prosecutors maintain he beat a young girl within an inch of her life. Campbell lives with his mother and an 8.5-month-old girl, presumably his daughter. He is legally responsible for her care, according to the complaint. Campbell's mom, the girl's grandmother, told police Kenya ran in one morning and said the baby fell and split her lip. According to doctors, the injuries were much more severe. The girl had a broken jaw and rib, a broken neck, lacerated liver, even bruises throughout her body. Doctors were amazed the girl survived and believe the injuries are from what they believe is a violent, massive assault.
When the news of Kenya's child abuse charges came out, it led to a lot of speculation online that maybe he had also abused Alexis or even killed her. The police looked into that possibility too, but they ran into an issue right away. I'll tell you about it next time on Unsolved. Unsolved is written and produced by me, Gina Barton. Ashley Luthern of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel assisted with reporting this season. Our sound engineer is Bill Schultz. Editors are Amy Pyle and Greg Borowski. Our theme music was composed by Evan Johnson. The TV news clips you heard in this episode came from TMJ4 News Milwaukee and WISN 12 News in Milwaukee. For more on Alexis's case or to sign up for our newsletter, visit usatoday.com/unsolved. My team's investigation into disparities in missing children's cases can be found at missing.usatoday.com.